Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 172 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be continuing the US Emily Step 1 Cardiology Review Series. This will be Series 5. And again, I'll talk about some high yield things and just, one housekeeping thing. So at the end of the podcast, I will just review the valvular pathologies again real quick, probably like in like 5-10 minutes. Because I don't know, it's just an area found to be hard for people to grapple with on MBME exams. So I will spend some very quick time at the end just talking about the high yield things that are tested with those and just move on from that. So let's jump right into it. What if you get a question about a child, right? And this child, you know, is the child of a mom that, you know, has maybe drank a ton of alcohol during pregnancy. And then they tell you that you hear a holosystolic murmur at the left lower sternal border in this kid. What's your diagnosis with that? That's a VSD, right? And obviously, a VSD is a bad thing. You know that it can ultimately progress to things like, at first, it will be like a left to right shunt. But, you know, over time, if you have like pulmonary hypertension, it can then become right to left. And then you have Eisenmenger physiology and all that badness. So we'll talk about that as we go along. So really, for the most part, I just want to, take a stab at the congenital heart diseases. I think the big thing you want to try to understand with the congenital heart diseases is first, understand how fetal heart circulation works. And then when I start talking about the different diseases, most of it will kind of make sense. And again, obviously, I'm not going to talk about all of them. I'm just going to talk about like the big ones. And then those big ones, the little ones where you need to know like one or two things about them, I'll kind of talk about that. So how does normal fetal circulation happen, right? So basically, right, the thing that happens is you essentially have the placenta. That's where like gas exchange happens. And then the placenta, it's almost like it's like you have multiple tubes and then they form one tube. That one tube is the umbilical vein, right? And then that umbilical vein, so because sometimes you'll actually see MBME exam questions where they ask that what vessel in the kid, right, especially when a kid is in utero, has the highest oxygen tension. That's actually the umbilical vein. So the umbilical vein, kind of sends blood. That blood keeps going. And then as it goes around the liver, it takes a detour called the ductus venosus. And then that ductus venosus, right, it ultimately forms inferior vena cava blood. The thing is that the IVC blood, for the most part, it goes to the right atrium. And once it's in the right atrium, it goes through the foramen ovale to the left atrium, right? And then from the left atrium, obviously, it'll go to the left ventricle and go to the rest of the body. On the other hand, blood that comes from the superior vena cava in a kid, the thing that usually happens is that most of that blood, it goes into the right atrium. From the right atrium, it goes to the right ventricle. So from the right ventricle, obviously, it will go into the pulmonary arteries, right? But the thing is, from the pulmonary arteries, it will actually go through the ductus arteriosus, okay? It will go through the ductus arteriosus to the aorta, and then it sort of continues down the rest of the aorta that way. And you may say, okay, Divine, why doesn't he go to the lungs? Well, think about it, right? A fetus, most of his lungs are bathed in fluid. So the fetal lungs are kind of hypoxic. And remember that hypoxia causes vasoconstriction, right? So that vasoconstriction essentially causes a really bad pulmonary, it's essentially a physiologic pulmonary hypertension in utero, right? So the pulmonary pressures are too high. So blood does not go from the pulmonary artery to like the pulmonary capillaries. No. What happens is blood goes through the ductus arteriosus from the pulmonary artery to the aorta. And then that blood from the aorta ultimately goes back to the placenta through the two umbilical arteries. Okay, so we have one umbilical vein and two umbilical arteries. If you have one umbilical artery, that typically has an association with having like other like congenital heart diseases. And that ductus arteriosus, the thing is, for the most part, whenever you have hypoxic conditions happening in a kid, that tends to keep the ductus arteriosus open, which is good in some way, because again, like I said, the relative hypoxia around the lungs of the fetus, can keep the ductus arteriosus open. And the thing is, the placenta also makes prostaglandin E2. Okay, prostaglandin E2 can now also actually help with it is actually the primary agent that helps with keeping that ductus arteriosus open. The thing that ultimately happens is, when a kid is born and they taking a deep breath, they go from hypoxia to, normoxia. And then those normoxic conditions, will increase the production of catecholamines, and that will cause a vasoconstriction of the ductus arteriosus, and it then becomes the ligamentum arteriosum, and essentially the ductus arteriosus closes. So, So again, everything goes back to the through those two umbilical arteries to the back to the placenta, so that you can repeat the whole cycle again. And then remember, right, that after a kid is born, like I said, the ductus arteriosus closes, and then the foramen ovale, for the most part, right, the ductus arteriosus, takes it a couple of days to close, but for the most part, the foramen ovale should really close within the first day, maybe 2 days, but usually the first day of life it should be closed, because the high pressures on the left side of the heart should essentially slam it shut against the right side of the heart, so it closes. Okay, and remember that the foramen ovale becomes like the fossa ovalis. That's one thing your friends at the MBME love to test on exams. So let's go ahead and jump to the congenital or heart diseases. The big thing you want to remember about these congenital heart diseases is just remember, because the thing is, right, many people try to like memorize, memorize, memorize. The thing is, memorization is not really going to get you very far with these congenital heart diseases, to be honest. Because the thing is, most times the MBME doesn't test your ability to memorize like crap with these congenital heart diseases. What the MBME tends to test for the most part is they just see, okay, can you analyze like hemodynamic factors that may occur in a person that has a certain congenital heart disease, right? So those are again big things you want to keep in mind. But I think before I start delving into them, I think it probably makes sense to talk about some high yield associations with some specific congenital heart diseases, right? One thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, if you remember, when I think I may have, in my genetic diseases podcast, I may have talked about Huntington's disease, where I said that, oh, it's a trinucleotide repeat disorder, autosomal dominant inheritance, CAG trinucleotide repeat, chromosome 4 is all screwed up, right? I talked about how those trinucleotide repeat disorders, especially for the most part, they tend to be inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. And then I talked about how they illustrate certain genetic principles, right? So I talked about how they demonstrate the principle of anticipation, right? Where, as future generations are born, the disease comes in a more severe form and it comes much earlier in life, right? So the thing is, whenever a condition demonstrates a genetic principle, that is something the MBM expects you to know, right? Also, kind of like the same thing with Prader-Willi and Angelman syndrome, right? And how they, talk about like genetic imprinting and uniparental disomy, right? Those are all high yield things you want to know. The thing is, the genetic principle you want to keep at the back of your mind with congenital heart diseases is that most of them have multifactorial inheritance. Okay, most of them have multifactorial inheritance. Multifactorial just means there are many things that it's not like, oh, like, I mean, yeah, there are some disorders that one-to-one relationship with congenital heart diseases, but really for the most part, there's many factors that come into play, like genetics, your environment, yada yada yada, into having a person that have a congenital heart disease. So multifactorial inheritance, that's one thing you really want to commit to memory for purposes of the MBM exam, right? And then remember, right, like of all the congenital heart diseases, right, the VSDs, it's pretty common. It's probably the most common on MBM exams. And remember that VSDs, they have an association with like infants of a diabetic mom. Right, like infants of diabetic mothers, they tend to have like they can either have like VSDs, they can have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. I talked about that in the prior podcast. And then kids where their mom consumed a ton of alcohol, in addition to like the smooth philtrum and all that stuff, they also tend to get VSDs. And then remember, right, rubella, right? So congenital rubella syndrome has an association with like patent ductus arteriosus, right? So those like weird key high yield associations, you want to keep them at the back of your mind. I mean, like lithium and Epstein's anomaly, right? Where you have like atrialization of the right ventricle, right? Remember, that's a key association. Or if mom is taking like phenytoin for like some seizure disorder that she has, that can cause something called a fetal hydantoin syndrome, right? So that's one association you want to keep in mind. Remember that when people have lupus, right, or when people have like Sjogren's syndrome, those anti-Rho and anti-La antibodies, they can cross the placenta and damage the conducting system in the fetus and cause like a third degree heart block, right? So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. Even Lyme disease can also ultimately cause a third degree heart block. So again, those are just again key associations you want to keep in mind. So I think those are probably like the big ones I'll go ahead and mention. So, and the thing is, congenital heart diseases, right? You can kind of classify them as, okay, like, are they cyanotic or acyanotic? That is probably the most common dichotomy that most people use when they are presenting this material to folks. And I think it's a good dichotomy. Obviously, the cyanotic congenital heart diseases are bad, right? Because you're cyanotic, right? So you're not supplying enough oxygen to your organs. And then the ones that are acyanotic, right? I mean, they're okay at first, but they ultimately become bad because most of these acyanotic congenital heart diseases, they tend to be associated with like a left to right shunt initially. But the thing is that left to right shunt can ultimately cause, especially if you don't treat, right? That left to right shunt can ultimately cause pulmonary hypertension, and then that left to right shunt then reverses and becomes a right to left shunt, right? Because the when you have pulmonary hypertension, the pressures in the right ventricle increase, so that essentially reverses the shunt, and then you then turn from an acyanotic heart defect to a cyanotic heart defect, right? And that can ultimately lead to, I mean, that phenomenon is known as like Eisenmenger complex, right? And that can ultimately cause cyanosis. And once people get that, those people usually end up requiring like a heart transplant for the most part. So sometimes they even need like a heart lung transplant, which is obviously not ideal, right? Now, if you remember earlier in this, like the podcast from last time, right? I said that when people have in endocarditis, right? Like I was talking about like the risk factors for endocarditis. I believe one of the things I said is that when people have congenital heart diseases, especially like the cyanotic ones, that actually increases their risk of having an endocarditis. So typically a classic NBME question may be a person that, you know, is getting like some kind of surgery and they have like a cyanotic congenital heart disease. Usually those people, especially if the cyanotic congenital heart disease has not been repaired, those people typically need some kind of antibiotic prophylaxis before the surgery starts, right? So you usually give like some kind of penicillin-based compound like ampicillin or something like that. That's actually something very high you would want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then I also said earlier that you want to make sure you are able to like analyze hemodynamic factors with regards to these congenital heart diseases on the USMLE exams. One big one you want to keep in mind is think about it, right? Like, if blood is coming from the rest of the body, right, obviously it comes in through the vena cava, right, like the SVC and IVC, right, comes in through those into the, you know, comes in through those to the right side of the heart, right, the right atrium, right, and obviously that blood is deoxygenated, right, I mean, it's not unoxygenated, it's deoxygenated, it still has some oxygen in it, I mean, the oxygen tension is probably like, you know, like 75% or thereabouts, right, so, you know, but the thing is, if you think about it, as you go from like, SVC, IVC to like right atrium, right ventricle, the blood oxygen tension should be decreasing, right? And then when you get to the lungs, the blood gets oxygenated and then it goes to the left side of the heart. That's what should happen normally, right? But if, for example, they give you an NBME question, and typically, you know, they'll make these questions bizarro and, you know, try to scare you or whatever, but these questions end up being like extremely easy if you know exactly what they're asking about. But if, for example, you notice that a person's oxygen, like blood oxygen saturation is rising as you go from the right atrium to the right ventricle, or as you go from like the right atrium, right ventricle to the pulmonary like arteries, that's not normal, right? That tells you that there must have been some kind of intermixture of blood that is deoxygenated and blood that is oxygenated. That essentially tells you that the person has a left to right shunt, okay? That's a very specific finding in left to right shunts on NBME exams. On the other hand, if they give you an NBME exam question and you notice that the oxygen tension is dropping as you go from like left atrium to left ventricle, or from like left atrium, left ventricle to the aorta, right? That tells you that there must have been some kind of intermixture of blood between the right side of the heart, essentially deoxygenated blood, and the left side of the heart, oxygenated blood, right? So that has brought down the oxygen tension. So whenever you see a decrement in oxygen tension as you go between chambers, like chambers on the left side of the heart, that tells you that the person likely has some kind of right to left shunt. Again, it may sound like a benign concept. I promise you, it's not a benign concept. They love to actually test this stuff on the USMLE exams, not just step one. They also love to test this stuff on step two CK, and they love to test this stuff on step three. And you will likely also see this stuff tested on the shelf exams you take in a third year. Okay, so again, these are all big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with tests. And the thing is, one thing that I guess I will go ahead and mention with left to right shunt, I don't know, for whatever bizarre reason, this concept is not usually emphasized quite well. Actually, I'll say maybe two concepts I want to talk about. So this thing, for whatever reason, is not, you know, typically emphasized quite well on NBME exams. Actually, I take that back. Three concepts I want to emphasize. These concepts, I guess, let me say what I want to say. These concepts, I don't know, for whatever reason, it doesn't just pop up on tests, common, not on tests, not in resources commonly, but I'm going to talk about it, right? So I think my first exposure to this concept was probably like in BRS physiology, something that kind of like modified my thinking on these congenital heart diseases, right? So here's the thing. Whenever a person has a left to right shunt, most times everyone says, oh, because of the left to right shunt, you know, the right ventricle will be, the right ventricle will be overloaded, which is true, right? You know, the right ventricle gets overloaded, the person ultimately gets, you know, pulmonary hypertension, right? And that causes trouble. But one thing you should actually remember is that when people have left to right shunts, that actually causes like, essentially like an eccentric hypertrophy of the left ventricle. So you may see divine, why is that? The reasoning behind that is when you have a left to right shunt, right, you're sending more blood from the left ventricle to the right ventricle. That extra blood in the right ventricle, you know, it will go to the lungs. That will cause like an increased venous return, pulmonary venous return ultimately to the left side of the heart. So because the left side of the heart is getting progressively volume overloaded, right, because it's just getting more venous return than it's used to, that's an example of a volume overload kind of situation, right? And that will ultimately cause a dilated cardiomyopathy from the eccentric hypertrophy. So again, that's one of those, you know, kind of like weird, bizarre things you want to keep at the back of your mind. That's the first thing. Second thing I wanted to mention is that when people have cyanotic congenital heart defects, one thing that tends to happen in these people is they tend to have like polycythemia, right? Because remember, whenever a person has a cyanotic congenital heart defect, they're cyanotic, right? So because they're cyanotic, they're in a state of hypoxia. And there's this, I believe it's a transcription factor. It's called like HIF-1 alpha. It's like hypoxia-inducible factor 1 alpha. When a person is hypoxic, that increases expression of that transcription factor, and you begin to make more and more erythropoietin. If you make more EPO, right, that will obviously increase the oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood. This is a very nice way. Your friends at the MBME love to integrate cardiology with pulmonology, right? Because the thing is, if you know that, because really kind of like the nice way to think about this is, if you know that you're cyanotic, right, you're hypoxic, let's say you have 10 buses, and those 10 buses, normally they could carry 20 people each, but now they can only carry 10 people, where you're like, okay, if I still want to meet the same demand, let me make more buses, let me make 10 extra buses. If I have 20 total buses carrying 10 people each, that'll be able to carry the 200 people I was able to carry initially, when those 10 buses I just had at the beginning carried 20 people. That's essentially what happened. So a reactive polycythemia classically arises in the setting of a cyanotic and congenital heart diseases, right? So essentially, in this kind of polycythemia, you know, the person's levels of EPO will be high. So their EPO levels will be high. And in addition to their EPO levels being high, right, you'll have very high levels of hemoglobin. The reason I'm talking about this is you want to be able to compare and contrast this with polycythemia vera. When people have polycythemia vera, they will have you know, like a crap ton of red blood cells. So, you know, they'll have like a big polycythemia. But the thing is, their EPO levels will actually be normal or low, okay? Their EPO levels will be normal or low. Remember that polycythemia vera is one of those myeloproliferative disorders, and it typically arises from like a JAK2 mutation, right? Again, and then remember that there are certain cancers that can produce EPO in a paraneoplastic fashion, right? Especially like renal cell carcinoma or like hemangioblastoma that has an association with the von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, like VHL. Remember, that's like a chromosome 3 issue. That can also cause those tumors, hemangioblastomas, renal cell carcinomas, those can produce EPO in a paraneoplastic fashion. And when you produce that EPO in a paraneoplastic fashion, that can also cause a polycythemia. Okay, so again, these are all big things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then one last thing I want to say about polycythemia, because again, this is kind of like a new area the MBME is beginning to take a lot of interest in, is that polycythemia is actually a normal finding in newborns, right? Because again, being a newborn, your lungs don't work, so you're hypoxic for the most part. If you're hypoxic, again, that will also cause a polycythemia. So you may see like a newborn, and you're like, man, this newborn's hemoglobin is really high. That's normal. It tends to normalize within like a few days to weeks, okay? That may also begin to give you some insight as to why newborns, you know, they can have like this, like jaundice, this like indirect hyperbilirubinemia. One of the reasons behind that is just newborns by default, just from the hypoxic nature of the uterus, right, just being in utero, as they're trying to get rid of all those excess red blood cells they have, right? Remember, as you break down red blood cells, they become indirect bilirubin, right? But the problem is the newborn's UDP, glucuronic cell transferase, that helps with conjugating bilirubin, you know, has not fully developed. That's why newborns tend to be at pretty, you know, pretty strong risk of having like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, and that ultimately causes jaundice. For the most part, you know, they tend to do well, but if they're not doing so well, obviously you want to consider things like phototherapy. Or if their bilirubin keeps rising despite phototherapy, you know, you want to think along the lines of like a partial exchange transfusion. Those are things you tend to see like on a pediatric shelf. And I'll probably talk some more about that when I do the gastroenterology reviews for the USMLE Step 1 exam. But again, I just thought I should, you know, kind of take that detour and talk about polycythemia, because it's a very, very high yield concept that tends to, again, kind of screw with a lot of people's heads on exams. So let's go ahead and jump to the first congenital heart disease, right? So the first one I want to talk about is a VSD, right? So, you know, VSDs, they're pretty common. They're actually the most common type of a congenital heart disease. And one thing you just, again, and I'm not going to, again, say every single little thing that you need to know about, like every single thing that you, I will say the things you need to know for exams. I'm not going to like go off the reservation or anything like that. But big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with VSDs. VSDs, right? They have this. It's essentially like a problem where you essentially have a hole between the right ventricle and the left ventricle, right? So the thing is, what should be in that hole, right? What should like be there normally, right? It's the interventricular septum, and the thing is, the interventricular septum, right? Remember, it has two parts. There's the membranous part, right? That's thinner, and then there is the muscular part that is thicker, right? So there's the membranous part of the interventricular septum, and then there's the muscular part of the interventricular septum. Again, if you're kind of understanding that, like, oh, membranous is thin, muscular is thick, and that should essentially already tell you that the membranous part should be the part that has the highest association with a VSD, right? So most VSDs, they tend to have that hole or that conduit between the right and left ventricles in the membranous interventricular septum. Okay, so what are some things that have associations with VSDs, right? So I've kind of talked about how, you know, infants of diabetic moms, they can have VSDs. Fetal alcohol syndrome has a big association with a VSD. Remember that people can also have like an interventricular septal rupture in the setting of an MI, right? So that's one thing that can cause like a VSD. But I mean, obviously, it'll be a VSD in a person that just had an MI, right? It won't be a VSD that, oh, as you're coming right out of the womb, no, right? It's something that, you know, will happen in an adult. And classically, the presentation of VSD is that it typically presents as like a holosystolic murmur, right, at the left lower sternal border, right? That's a big thing. And again, I've already talked about some of the hemodynamic consequences of having a VSD, right? So again, like I said, if you see, because the left side of the heart, right, has higher pressures than the right side, right? Obviously, in a VSD, blood will flow from the left side to the right, like left ventricle to right ventricle. That can ultimately cause a pulmonary hypertension, right? And that pulmonary hypertension can cause like a concentric hypertrophy of the right ventricle, okay? But again, like I said, when a person has a VSD, there's more blood going from the left side of the heart to the right side of the heart, so it's acyanotic at first, right? That more blood going to the right side of the heart will increase the pulmonary venous return to the left side of the heart. So that will volume overload the left side of the heart. So that will cause an eccentric hypertrophy of the left side of the heart, okay? And that can ultimately cause a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So whenever you see a person, you're like, this person has concentric hypertrophy in the right ventricle and eccentric hypertrophy on the left ventricle, those people almost always have like some preceding left to right shunt business going on, okay? And again, remember that whole business I talked about with like oxygen tension, like the oxygen saturation in the blood going on between right atrium and right ventricle, that's not so. Whenever you see that on an MBM exam, the very first thing I want you to think about is that person potentially having some kind of a left to right shunt, okay? And again, remember, VSDs, if you don't fix them, you can ultimately end up with the Eisenmenger complex. And one other weird thing to keep in mind with VSDs, right, is like, again, where the murmur is heard best. The murmur is heard best at the left lower sternal border, okay? So be a holosystolic murmur heard best at the left lower sternal border. Holosystolic murmur heard best at the left lower sternal border. Those are the big things you want to keep. And sometimes instead of putting the word holosystolic on MBM exams, you know, they can call it like pansystolic, holosystolic. It's just two names for the same thing. Okay. And really, for the most part, most VSDs, you know, they tend to close on their own. But you know, if they don't close, you gotta fix it with surgery. So I think that's all I'm going to say with VSDs. I mean, obviously, if I just talked about a VSD, you know, I want to talk about an ASD as well, right? So ASDs, big things, really, there's thankfully not much you actually need to know about ASDs. But ASDs, the big things you want to remember, you want to remember that they are associated with like a wide fixed split of the S2 heart sound. I believe I've talked about that in a different podcast. If I have not, I will talk about it when I start talking about like EKGs and cardiac physiology. Yeah, those things tend to be a little, I would not want to talk about it here because I don't want to cause like a brain overload for whoever is listening to this podcast. I'll talk about the mechanisms behind that in a different podcast that hopefully should come up sooner rather than later. So the thing is, you know, ASD, right? Classic wide fixed split of the S2 heart sound. That's like the big association. And again, that will, you have essentially, because blood is, because the pressures on the left side of the heart are much higher than the pressures on the right side of the heart, right? Blood will flow from the left atrium to the right atrium, right? And again, that will overload the right ventricle, cause pulmonary hypertension. If left untreated for long enough, the person can have an Eisenmenger physiology. I think maybe I'll stop repeating this Eisenmenger physiology business and this whole thing of like blood, like oxygen tensions are stepping up from the right atrium to the right ventricle. I think you should kind of get that point by now. It's kind of like a common thing with any left to right shunt. And the thing is, with an ASD, right, remember that Down syndrome actually has an association with atrial septal defect. The big thing I want to mention though with Down syndrome is the most common congenital heart defect in people with Down syndrome is actually something called an endocardial cushion defect. An endocardial, this is very high of, an endocardial cushion defect is the most common congenital heart defect that's found in kids with Down syndrome, right? But the thing is, kids with Down syndrome, they tend to also have ASDs. And the kind of, so maybe let me set this straight. There are two kinds of ASD a person can have. A person can have something called a secundum ASD, okay? A secundum ASD, and again, I will talk about this ostium secundum, ostium primum, yada, yada, yada. And again, I'll have another podcast just on cardiac embryology. Yeah, cardiology is one of the highest yield subjects you can ever know in the USMLE Step 1 exam. So I'll have podcasts dedicated to that. But basically, right, an ostium secundum ASD is actually the most common type of ASD, like if you take five people with ASDs, four of them will have the secundum ASD. The thing is, the primum ASD is very, very rare. But if you ever find a primum ASD, that patient likely has Down syndrome, okay? That patient likely has Down syndrome. That's, again, one of just those weird associations you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And then remember that if a person has an ASD, right, if they have a DVT, that's bad. Because the thing is, usually, right, when people think of a DVT, they think, oh, you know, this person is going to get a PE. Because essentially the thing that happens is, you know, the DVT will track along the venous system, go to the right side of the heart, and then lodge somewhere in the lungs and then cause a PE, right? It will occlude a pulmonary artery, cause a PE. But the thing is, when people have an ASD, they can have something called like a paradoxical embolus. That's, again, a high yield concept you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Because basically, the clot can make its way from the right atrium to the left atrium, left ventricle, and then cause a stroke. That's what's known as a paradoxical embolus. That's a classic pathognomonic NBME exam finding in people that have an ASD, especially. That's why you can actually, like, sometimes when people have like strokes and you're like, man, this stroke is kind of weird. This person just had a DVT and they have a stroke. One thing that cardiologists typically do is they do something called like a bubble study under like echocardiography to kind of figure out if there is any unusual connection between the left side of the heart and the right side of the heart. Now, the next congenital heart disease I'll talk about, right, this one is the one that's associated with like rubella, right? So like congenital rubella syndrome, or they may tell you that this person has like a machinery murmur, right? Like a continuous machine-like murmur. If you see that, right, obviously you're thinking about a PDA, right? Again, a PDA, for the most part, remember the ductus arteriosus is a conduit between the pulmonary arteries and the aorta, right? So the thing that happens when a person has a PDA is that ductus arteriosus is supposed to close within the first few hours or days of life. If it doesn't close, you know, you essentially have a conduit between the aorta, which represents the left side of the heart, and the pulmonary artery, which represents the right side of the heart, right? So it ultimately becomes like a left to right shunt. And again, if you keep overloading the pulmonary arteries, that can ultimately cause like a pulmonary hypertension, and then that can cause so you get the, you know, the person can get the pulmonary hypertension. And then if they get the pulmonary hypertension, they can ultimately get, you know, like Eisenmenger physiology develop, right? Because again, they can have like right heart failure and all that badness happen. And again, like I said, the big key associations we want to remember, right? Congenital rubella syndrome. And again, anything that causes hypoxia in utero, because again, hypoxia, this is actually a very high yield thing to know. Hypoxia increases the amount of prostaglandin E2. And you may say, Divine, why does that make any sense? Well, think about it. If a part of the body is hypoxic, right? The body will be like, okay, let me try to dilate the vessels that lead to this hypoxic region. And it so happens that prostaglandin E2 is a vasodilator, right? So if you're hypoxic, you'll produce more of a vasodilating agent like prostaglandin E2, and that will keep blood vessels, you know, maximally dilated so that more blood can flow through them to that hypoxic region. So when a person is hypoxic in utero, let's say like they have like respiratory distress syndrome, for example, right? Or a person has like some kind of cyanotic congenital heart defect, like tetralogy of Fallot, those things can all cause patent ductus arteriosus again, because that hypoxia increases levels of prostaglandin E2. And again, like I said, right, people can have maybe I should take a small step back here. Not necessarily Eisenmenger physiology, but it's almost like, how do I put this? It's almost like a derivative of Eisenmenger physiology. So let me talk about this real quick for a second, right? So think about it. When a person has a patent ductus arteriosus, and maybe I should throw this in here, you treat it with indomethacin, right? Indomethacin, you know, it's a COX inhibitor, cyclooxygenase inhibitor. If you inhibit COX, you'll decrease the production of prostaglandin E2, right? And then your catecholamine system will be able to take hold sway, and that will kind of like constrict down the ductus arteriosus and fix the problem. But this tends to work mostly in premature kids, or like within the first hours or like days of life. If the person, you notice like a ductus arteriosus, like, you know, like years into life or whatever, you're going to have to do surgery. There's not much you're going to be able to do with, essentially indomethacin is not going to do squat for you at that point. You're going to have to do surgery. So let me say something here. The thing is, when people have a ductus arteriosus, right? Like a patent ductus arteriosus, I said that blood will flow from the aorta to the pulmonary artery, right? And you know, you can get pulmonary hypertension and all that badness happen. Here's the thing. Usually when people have these ductus arteriosus, right? Usually arises after the subclavian artery. That's usually what normal anatomy kind of like goes with, right? You know, you have this ductus arteriosus below the subclavian artery. So the thing that can happen is that when a person has pulmonary hypertension from this, you know, this chronic PDA, the thing that can happen is the shunt can reverse from going, like blood going from the aorta to the pulmonary artery to blood now going from the pulmonary artery to the aorta. But the thing is, the part of the aorta it goes to is the aorta that is distal to the subclavian artery. So in general, these people will actually not have any problems in the upper extremities. Remember, the subclavian artery kind of kickstarts like the axillary artery, the brachial artery, right? So like essentially the upper extremities are covered, right? So they may present this PDA question to you as an MBME question where a person has like cyanosis in their lower extremities and they're acyanotic in their upper extremities, right? So like, oh, the upper extremities look great, the lower extremities don't look so great. If you see that, you really want to actually consider a patent ductus arteriosus, like a chronic PDA, where these people now have like a reversal of the shunt. And again, sometimes that concept is known as a differential cyanosis, okay? Differential cyanosis, because like this person's upper body looks awesome, but this person's lower body looks not awesome. Whenever you see that, you really want to think about patent ductus arteriosus and the associated differential cyanosis because the shunt has reversed. Now, the next one, I think, congenital heart defect I think I'll talk about, right, is like tetralogy of Fallot. Essentially, I'll just tell you this, right? You'll be doing yourself a huge disservice if you're taking the USMLE Step 1 exam, right, and you've not reviewed tetralogy of Fallot. Just one of those things that you're kind of asking for it if you don't know. Like, they test this stuff all the time on Step 1, all the time on Step 2 CK, all the time on Step 3. And then the pediatric shelf exam, they eat this stuff up, right? So they almost always test this stuff on exam. So it's just one of these things that if you don't learn it now, it'll just essentially haunt you for the rest of your test-taking career. So basically, what's the big thing with tetralogy of Fallot? The way I kind of think about tetralogy of Fallot is, I mean, you want to obviously know the four findings, right? But the thing is, the four findings, and I'll probably make a slide on this that I will post when I talk about cardiac embryology. But let me try to describe it in words if I can, right? So basically, the thing is, the normal thing that happens is, you know, you have like the muscular interventricular septum that kind of grows from the bottom of the heart. So just think of the heart as a box. Again, this is not very accurate, but you'll get the point. So essentially, the thing that happens is, so think of the heart as like a square box, right? So just try to visualize it as you're listening to this podcast. Think of the heart as a square box. And then in the from the bottom of that square box, you have like a stump that grows. That's the muscular interventricular septum. The thing is to, you know, kind of divvy things up nicely, to divide the right and the left ventricle nicely. I've already talked about what's growing from the bottom, the muscular interventricular septum. Well, something has to go from the top, the membranous interventricular septum, and meets that muscular interventricular septum, like up, it must meet it, like those two ends must approximate nicely. I kind of think of it as like almost like a lock and key. You want those two, I mean, if a lock or a key are not aligned properly, then they won't meet well and you won't have this nice interlocking mechanism. So the thing is that when people have a tetralogy of Fallot, the way I've always thought about the pathophysiology, and you'll see that this is a very useful way to understand it, is the way I've always thought about the pathophysiology is that instead of the that thing that grows from the top to meet the muscular interventricular septum, in lockstep, the thing that happens is that thing that's supposed to meet it from the top, instead of coming down and meeting the muscular interventricular septum, it comes down to the right of the muscular interventricular septum. The thing is, when you have that happening, when you have that thing coming down to the right of the muscular interventricular septum, then you don't have that lock and key mechanism anymore. And because that thing comes off to the right of the muscular interventricular septum, you see that the interventricular septum essentially doesn't form properly. So a VSD develops. That's one finding already in a person that has tetralogy of Fallot, right? And because, again, that thing that grows from the top, and again, I will describe this better with a diagram that I'll post with a, you know, the later podcast. When that thing comes from the top, because it's growing to the right? In fact, let me give you a little more background here. The thing that grows down from the top and ultimately forms the membranous interventricular septum that meets up with the muscular interventricular septum is actually the aorticopulmonary septum. Okay, it's actually the aorticopulmonary septum. So look at the name, aorticopulmonary septum. That means it's a septum that divides the aorta and the pulmonary system, right? It divides the aorta and the pulmonary artery system, essentially. So the thing that happens is, if this aorticopulmonary septum comes down to the right of the muscular, so it comes down to the right anatomically of the muscular interventricular septum, you'll see that you have more space, because you're essentially not partitioning things equally, right? Because normally you want to come down right in the middle, you give equal space to the pulmonary artery, you give equal space to the aorta. But when this aorticopulmonary septum comes down to the right of the muscular interventricular septum, you give a crap ton of space to the aorta, aka overriding aorta, and then you give very limited space to the pulmonary artery, aka pulmonic stenosis. And the thing is, when you have pulmonic stenosis, it'll be hard for blood to be ejected from the right ventricle. So that will cause a right ventricular hypertrophy, okay? If you understand what I just explained, you will never, like, to be honest with you, I have never forgotten the four findings in tetralogy of Fallot, because I just remember this construct in my mind, right? So just to repeat, the four findings: right ventricular hypertrophy, pulmonic stenosis, overriding aorta, okay, and a VSD. And again, all these things should make perfect sense if you understand what I just explained. So those are the big, you know, big four findings in tetralogy of Fallot. And then what are some other key things you want to keep at the back of your mind with tetralogy of Fallot, right? So the thing is, you want to, you know, be able to recognize like the classic TET spells, okay? So those TET spells, they tend to arise, you know, when the kid is like crying or when the kid is sick. Because the thing is, when you cry, that actually, like, you know, kind of worsens the cyanosis, right? So, you know, that worsens the cyanosis, and then the kid turns blue, right? That's what they call like the blue baby, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, the kid, you know, kind of turns blue. But the thing is, once the cyanosis, they may say, oh, so how do you relieve this TET spell? Well, the thing that typically happens is when the kid squats, that relieves the TET spell. So you may say, okay, Divine, why does that help? Well, think about it. When you squat, you're essentially squishing on your vessels, on the big vessels of your body. And when you squish on the big vessels of your body, because the thing is, tetralogy of Fallot, because there is the pulmonic stenosis, it's a cyanotic heart defect for the most part. So it's a right to left shunt, right? So it's a cyanotic defect, because blood that is not going to the lungs is going to the left side of the heart and then going to the rest of the body. So it's a cyanotic heart defect. So that right to left shunt is bad because it's causing cyanosis. So the thing is, when you squat, you compress the big arteries of the body, that will increase afterload on the left ventricle. When that increases afterload on the left ventricular pressures will go up. And when the left ventricular pressures go up, that will turn the right to left shunt of the trilogy of Fallot to a left to right shunt, right? So it will go from a cyanotic shunt to an asyanotic shunt. And that's why squatting relieves the cyanosis that's associated with tetralogy of Fallot. Now, you may say, but Divine, these TET spells, like, why do these kids become very cyanotic when they cry? Well, the thing is, think about it. And I mean, you probably experienced this as a kid, you know, from crying. I mean, there's no kid that has not cried. Like, if a kid cries and cries, like, really well, crying is almost like a self-induced Valsalva maneuver, right? And because if you notice, if you like if a person cries, right, like I don't know if I should try to model this or anything like that, people probably get a laugh from this, but when a person like cries like right, when you're taking air, like when you're like you're crying, like that phase where you're like letting out this cry, that is essentially like raising your intrathoracic pressures. And when those intrathoracic pressures rise, guess what? Your venous return goes down. And if your venous return goes down, you have very little blood in the right side of the heart, right? So that will worsen your cyanosis because you just don't have enough blood that carries oxygen because you're already in hot water with having to deal with a right to left shunt. And then even that little right to left shunt that at least is giving you some little oxygen, even if it's not enough, then you're now cutting off that supply by raising your intrathoracic pressures and lowering venous return. That's bad, right? So that's why crying or like severe illness, just anything that, you know, places a big metabolic demand on your body can trigger the cyanosis, classically known as the TET spells in tetralogy of Fallot. And really, tetralogy of Fallot, for the most part, you treat it with, you know, you treat it with surgery. There's really not much you can do there. Actually, I think it was a cardiologist at my alma mater that actually, discovered the procedure for fixing a tetralogy of Fallot. But that's a story. That's a story for another day. So again, these are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with tetralogy of Fallot. So I think that's all I want to say about tetralogy of Fallot. And again, like I said, fix it with surgery. Now, one thing you maybe want to keep at the back of your mind, another high yield congenital heart defect is coarctation of the aorta, right? So coarctation of the aorta, remember it has like a very big prominent association with like Turner syndrome, right? Remember Turner syndrome, those people tend to get like coarctation of the aorta, they tend to get bicuspid aortic valve, so that can cause aortic stenosis. And remember that those people also tend to get, there's this renal problem they have, horseshoe kidney, right? Where like the inferior poles of the kidney, you know, they stay fused. So they're kind of stuck under the inferior mesenteric artery, you know, kind of increases their risk of like hypertension, increases their risk of, like just chronic recurring UTIs, right? Again, all high yield things you want to keep in mind for exams. So coarctation of the aorta, right? Like the classic presentation is, you know, you may see like in a chest x-ray, the person may have like rib notching, right? So like rib notching, that's in fact, I think at the end I would go ahead and in fact, you know, let me go ahead and talk about this right now, right? Just some key like weird like imaging findings in some of these congenital heart diseases, because they love to test this thing. And then I'll actually say something that, you know, I kind of neglected to mention. So if you see the mention of the name boot-shaped heart on an MBM exam, okay, so boot-shaped heart on an MBM exam, I will strongly encourage you to think about tetralogy of Fallot. Okay, it just happens because the person has a right ventricular hypertrophy. So boot-shaped heart, think about tetralogy of Fallot. And then if you see, they tell you that, oh, this person's heart on chest x-ray looks like an egg on a string, right? If you see like an egg on a string heart, I would really, really want you to think about a transposition of the great vessels. I'll talk about that shortly in a second. So egg on a string heart, think about transposition of the great vessels. If you see rib notching on a chest x-ray, right, you really do want to think about a coarctation of the aorta. One weird thing you may also see, they may tell you that, oh, the person's heart's on chest x-ray, you kind of see like something called the snowman sign. Okay, the snowman sign kind of goes with something called TAPVR, right? So like total anomalous pulmonary venous return. That's like the big association of snowman sign. I think really those are the big ones you want to know. I mean, there are some other weird things you may see, but this is more like for the interest of radiologists, like there's like the scimitar sign and the gooseneck sign, yada yada yada. Yeah, those things are all things that is more important for radiologists than a medical student. So I think we'll kind of like leave that. I mean, probably the only other one that's probably also kind of important is something called like the double density sign. Right, so the double density sign, it's classically something you see like in a person that has like hypertrophy of the left atrium. Like, you know, if a person has like a big dilated left atrium, that tends to be associated with a double density sign. But yeah, I think those are kind of like the big signs you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then maybe another one you may keep in mind is like the water bottle sign, right? Where the heart looks like a water bottle. Again, don't confuse this with boot-shaped heart. The water bottle sign, when the heart looks like a water bottle, I want you to think about a person that has a large pericardial effusion. Okay, large pericardial effusion, or if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, kind of has like calcifications outlining the heart on a chest X-ray or chest CT, that person has constrictive pericarditis. Okay, that person's got a constrictive pericarditis. Again, these are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. So let's get back to coarctation of the aorta, right? So I've talked about the association with a Turner syndrome, right? So what are some other things you want to keep at the back of your mind with a coarctation of the aorta? The thing is, there are actually two types of aortic coarctation, right? So there's the one that is preductal, and then there's the one that is productal. And there's one called juxtaductal, but that one is very low yield. It's highly unlikely to show up on any exam you'll see. So I think I'll maybe only talk about like the preductal and the postductal ones. So the thing is, the preductal one tends to be found in kids, right? Like in infants, right? Like, you know, in the first like year or two of life, that's the preductal one. And the easy way to remember that the preductal is tends to be found in adults is that, I mean, sorry, the preductal tends to be found in kids. The way to remember that is kids come before adults, right? So pre goes before post. Okay, so pre goes before post. So that's the way I kind of remember most of these things. So the thing is, essentially, this pre or post that I'm talking about essentially refers to the doctor's arteriosus. People that have a preductal coarctation, aka kids, the coarctation arises before the doctor's arteriosus. People that have the postductal coarctation, they have this coarctation arise after the doctor's arteriosus. Well, why is this preductal one? I mean, the preductal, both of them are bad, to be honest. Both are bad. But why is the preductal one, why is it broken down this way? The thing is, when a person has a preductal coarctation of the aorta, the thing that happens is that the coarctation is coming before the doctor's arteriosus. So one thing that can actually happen is that these kids, they can actually supply blood to the distal aorta, aka the aorta distal to the subclavian artery, by effectively sending blood from the pulmonary artery, although it's deoxygenated though, blood from the pulmonary artery through the ductus arteriosus to the distal aorta. So that's how they can supply blood to their lower body. Okay. Only problem is when you have that coarctation of the aorta just before the ductus, you're kind of screwed, right? Because that's essentially like a left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, right? So that can essentially cause like really bad heart failure in kids, because essentially the blood in their left ventricle really has nowhere to go other than the proximal aorta, which is bad, right? So that's just one of those weird high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with the preductal coarctation of the aorta. And again, like I said, it tends to be found more in kids. And the thing is, of all the aortic coarctations, the preductal type is actually the most common type of coarctation. It's like more than 50% of all aortic coarctations arise in the setting of a preductal coarctation. Now, the postductal one, you know, you tend to find it in adults, but you can also, again, find it in kids because, again, right, most aortic coarctation cases you'll see in your life are probably in kids if you see it at all, right? So, postductal coarctation, so the coarctation occurs after the ductus arteriosus, right? It occurs after the ductus arteriosus. So one big problem that you kind of see with this aortic coarctation, the postductal type, is that these people have a lot of trouble sending blood to their lower extremities, right? So that is what essentially gives you like the classic presentation of aortic coarctation on MBM exams, where a kid will have very high blood pressures. Like this kid will have like but hypertension. And then they'll tell you that this person, like, they present this in multiple different ways on NBME tests. They may tell you that the person has high blood pressures in the upper extremities and low blood pressures in the lower extremities, right? If you see like a difference in systolic blood pressure of like 10 or 15 or 20 between the upper extremities and lower extremities, that's not normal, right? You're likely dealing with aortic coarctation under those circumstances, especially like the postdoctoral type. Now, another way they may present that on MBME exams is because, again, they know that many people have memorized this, high blood pressures in the upper extremities, low blood pressures in the lower extremities. They know everyone has memorized all that crap. So one thing they are starting to do is they may tell you that the person has a radial femoral pulse delay. I'll say that again, radiofemoral pulse delay. Where, because normally, right, you can even check this on yourself, although I don't know how possible that is, but if you touch your femoral pulse around your groin and you touch your radial pulse, they essentially arrive at the same time. What if you're like, man, I can feel my radial pulse and my femoral pulse is not, it's like, man, it's taking its sweet time to come. If you see that, then you really want to think about aortic coarctation and MBMEs again, because remember, the radial artery is ultimately a derivative of the subclavian artery, and the subclavian artery arises from the aortic arch before essentially every coarctation that you will see on MBME exams, right? So those people have good perfusion of the upper extremities and awful perfusion of their lower extremities, right? So that's one other way you can present. Another way you can present is they may tell you that, oh, this patient has like 2 or 3 plus, like they will tell you the person has like 3 plus like radial pulses, to tell you that this person's radial pulse is like really, really high, right? And then they may tell you that pulses are barely detectable in like the dorsalis pedis or the posterior tibial arteries. If you see that, think about, again, coarctation of the aorta on MBME exams. And the thing is, if you see, because many people are used to like, oh, like, you know, long-term smoker has pain that is very bad in both legs and it's relieved after the person, you know, rests for a while, and they're like, oh, this person has low extremity claudication, of which smoking is the biggest risk factor. The thing is, if you see claudication in a very young person, I really want you to think about coarctation of the aorta. Because again, you're essentially hypoperfusing your lower extremity blood vessels. And if you hypoperfuse your lower extremity blood vessels, that can cause a lower extremity claudication. So again, that's actually something very high yield you want to keep at the back of your mind on MBME exams. Okay, so if you see claudication in a very young person, especially a person that hasn't smoked or whatever, think about a coarctation of the aorta. Right, and the thing is, these people tend to have hypertension for many different reasons. Right, the reason they have a lot of hypertension is that, one, there's just nowhere for the blood to go, right, in the upper extremities, right? So I mean, in the upper body, because of that coarctation, right? So they have like upper extremity hypertension. But another thing is, think about it, one of the offshoots of the descending aorta, right, especially like the abdominal aorta, is the renal artery, right? So people that have coarctation of the aorta, they're not perfusing the renal artery very well, right? So if they're not perfusing the renal artery, the afferent arterial is not seeing enough blood. So the juxtaglomerular cells begin to freak out and they begin to secrete a lot of renin, right? And again, that will kickstart the whole renin angiotensin aldosterone system, right? And that will raise blood volume, that will cause vasoconstriction, and that will ultimately cause a hypertension, okay? That will ultimately cause hypertension. And the thing is, these people, because they have such elevated pressures prior to the coarctation, that can actually cause the upper extremity hypertension that they have can actually go ahead and cause aortic dissection, okay? So aortic dissection is actually pretty common in people that have a history of aortic coarctation, okay? That's actually a very high yield relationship you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. Because actually the biggest risk factor, believe it or not, for aortic dissection is a hypertension, right? And then another thing these people can also have, they can also get like strokes from like subarachnoid hemorrhage, because again, the pressure is proximal to the coarctation, right? Like those pressures kind of involve the cerebral vessels as well, because remember, your carotids and everything, they've all come off before the coarctation. So the blood vessels in the brain, right, they're exposed to like very high pressures, very, very high pressures, and those high pressures can kind of cause the formation of all these like barioaneurysms, and those can rupture and cause a subarachnoid hemorrhage, right? Remember, the biggest risk factor for stroke is hypertension, right? So these like cardiovascular risk factors, they actually kind of expect you to know them for MBME exams. So the biggest risk factor for stroke an aortic dissection. The way I remember that is SAD, right? So like SAD, like S-A-D. I hope none of you are SAD, but so stroke, aortic dissection, the biggest risk factor is hypertension. And then a myocardial infarction, a triple A, so like an abdominal aortic aneurysm, and a claudication of the lower extremities. The biggest risk factor for all those things is smoking. Okay, those risk factors, again, believe it or not, they tend to test them quite commonly on the USMLE exams. Okay, so I think those are like the big things I want to say with coarctation of the aorta. But the one, again, I know I'm spending a lot of time on this and I apologize, but one thing I also want to say is this is actually one area that the NBMA also loves to pick off with regards to anatomical concepts, okay? They love to pick this off with anatomical concepts on the exam. Because the thing is, right, many people tell me like, oh, Divine, how do I remember, how do I study anatomy for step one? If anatomy is clinically relevant, it's typically something you'd want to know for tests. And I mean, thankfully, I've, you know, made a decent number of anatomy podcasts for step one that you can review, and I will make even more in the future, right? But typically with these different podcasts I make for like the different systems, I will also be talking about like the high yield relevant clinical anatomy. So one thing I'll go ahead and say is coarctation of the aorta has some very nifty but high yield anatomical relationships. So the thing is, obviously people, especially that have this postdoctoral coarctation, they gotta send blood in some way, shape, or form to their lower extremities, right? I mean, you can't like say, oh, I'm not gonna give my lower extremities blood. So the thing is, the body begins to develop some collateral systems, like some collateral circulatory systems to kind of keep your lower extremities perfused. One big one you want to remember is the collateral circulation between the superior epigastric artery and the inferior epigastric artery, right? So here's the thing. Right. If you're looking at a person's aorta, like I said, these postdoctoral coarctations, they tend to arise after the doctor's arteriosus. The doctor's arteriosus for sure comes after the subclavian artery. Right. So the thing is, all the vessels, like you have like your brachiocephalic artery given off first, and then you have your left common carotid, and then you give off your left subclavian. So all those vessels are given off before the coarctation. Even if it's pre-doctor, they are all given off before the coarctation. So the thing that happens is, your subclavian artery, one of the branches of the subclavian artery is the internal thoracic artery, okay? The thing is, as the internal thoracic artery descends in the thoracic cavity on both sides of the sternum, the name changes at some point, especially when it's like essentially like traversed, I think, the diaphragm. The name changes from internal thoracic artery to superior epigastric artery. The thing is, when a person has coarctation of the aorta, because again, there is still more than adequate blood flow in the subclavian artery, some of that blood will be shunted towards the internal thoracic artery, and then from the internal thoracic artery, it'll be shunted to the superior epigastric artery, which is essentially just a name change of the internal thoracic artery once it like gets into the abdomen. The thing is, that superior epigastric artery can form a conduit with the inferior epigastric artery. And it so happens that the inferior epigastric artery is a branch of the external iliac artery, right? I remember the external iliac is one of the terminal branches of the descent of the abdominal aorta, okay? So that can then, you can then have like retrograde blood flow in the external iliac artery to supply derivatives of the abdominal aorta and also the lower extremities. So that's one high yield anatomical association you want to know. The other anatomical association you want to know is that there is this conduit that also develops between the intercostal arteries, right? There's the conduit that develops between the intercostal arteries. The thing is, there are the anterior intercostal arteries, and then there are the posterior intercostal arteries. The thing is, the anterior intercostal arteries, they are branches of the internal thoracic. So really, for these aortic coarctations, the easy way to remember this is that all roads go through the internal thoracic artery, right? So the anterior intercostal arteries are branches of the internal thoracic artery. So the thing is, when again you have ample blood flow in the subclavian artery because of the coarctation, you have more blood flowing into the internal thoracic artery, and then you have more blood flowing into the from the internal thoracic artery to the anterior intercostal arteries. And those anterior intercostal arteries, they actually establish conduits with the posterior intercostal arteries. It so happens that those posterior intercostal arteries, they tend to arise more from like the descending aorta. So they tend to arise more from the parts of the aorta that are distal to the coarctation, right? So this is why people that have aortic coarctation, they tend to have like rib notching. Because remember those intercostal arteries, this is actually another high yield anatomical relationship to remember. Those intercostal arteries, they sort of run in a neurovascular bundle at the lower margin of a rib. Or I guess if you're looking at it from a different perspective, you can say like the upper margin of an intercostal space. Okay, remember, the lower margin of a rib is the same thing as the upper margin of the space between ribs, aka the intercostal spaces. Remember, they love to test that in the context of, oh, if you want to put a chest tube or something, in which direction do you want to go in the intercostal space? You want to go above the rib or below the rib? Obviously, you want to go above the rib, right? Because that's the most inferior part of the intercostal space, so you avoid the neurovascular bundle. If you do it above the rib, if you do it below the rib, so you want to go above the rib, you don't want to go below the rib. If you go below the rib, well, all the best, right? Because you can puncture one of the intercostal arteries, cause a life-threatening bleed, and then the person can die. You don't want that, right? So in general, right, those intercostal arteries, they run in the neurovascular bundle, again, below the rib, or the, which is the same thing as the upper margin of the intercostal space. So the thing is, those intercostal arteries, because they have like more blood flow in them, right, that increased blood flow, those vessels become more pulsatile, and those pulsations begin to like wear away the bone, like the ribs essentially, right? So that's why you get like those rib notches. Sometimes it can cause something called the 3 sign on a chest x-ray, right? Those are all classic findings in people that have coarctation of the aorta. And really, again, coarctation of the aorta, it's only surgery that's going to help you. There's really not much you can do there. And then I guess maybe, so I'll just go ahead and say this right now, the spiel I wanted to do on the quick hits on the valves, I'll have to do it in another podcast. I mean, obviously I'm already over an hour here, but I'm going to be done, very shortly. The last thing I think I'll go ahead and talk about, right, like, I'll just say like one or two quick things about these remaining congenital heart defects. There's really not much here to know. But transposition of the great vessels, you just want to think about it as, you know, problems with like the aorticopulmonary septum. Remember, the aorticopulmonary septum is derived from neurocrest. That's a high yield thing to know for exams. And essentially, the thing that happens is, it's called a transposition of the great vessels. Well, what are your great vessels? Your great vessels are your aorta and your pulmonary artery. The thing that happens is, normally, your aorta comes off of the left ventricle, and your pulmonary artery comes off of your right ventricle, right? And the thing that will cause this transposition is when you have like problems with like the appropriate twisting of your, or like switch, like turning of the aortic pulmonary septum. And again, I'll talk about all this, the pathophysiology behind all this stuff in the cardiac embryology podcast. That's another, I'll say probably of all the embryologists to know on the USMLE exams, neuroembryology, cardioembryology, and GI embryology is probably the highest yield that you want to keep at the back of your mind on tests. So, you know, if you have problems with like the spin or the turning of the aorticopulmonary septum, that's essentially what causes a transposition of the great vessels. So when you have this transposition, the pulmonary artery actually arises from the left ventricle and the aorta arises from the right ventricle. And that's bad, right? Because think about it. If a person has like a complete transposition, let's say like the right ventricle sends blood to the aorta, the aorta will send blood to the rest, and again, it's right ventricular blood, right? So that's deoxygenated blood. You're sending that deoxygenated blood into the aorta. It will send it to the rest of the body. That will deoxygenate the blood some more. And then the blood will come back through the SVC-IVC to the right side of the heart, go to the right ventricle, and then come out through the aorta again. That's bad. I mean, that's obviously not very compatible with, that's not compatible with life pretty much. So you have like one closed deoxygenated system for the right side of the heart, and you have one closed oxygenated system for the left side of the heart. That is, again, not very compatible with life. So usually, if a kid is to be born with a transposition of the great vessels, typically they will have like some kind of thing that is maintaining communication between the right side of the heart and the left side of the heart, so you can have some mixing of blood. If not, there's no way those kids ever get born, right? So, you know, they'll need like an ASD or a VSD or a PDE to keep those things open. So with that said, there's a very actually classic USMLE exam question. It may give you a question about like a kid that, you know, this kid is born. And this kid, you know, their Apgar scores were great at birth. And then they tell you that within a few hours of birth, or like the second day, usually it's like within the few hours or like the first few days of birth, this kid then suddenly becomes like profoundly cyanotic, profoundly hypoxic, profoundly hypotensive. If you see that and they ask for the next best step in management, your next best step in management on the USMLE exams is to administer a drug known as alprostadil. Okay, alprostadil. They usually write these questions with like very little in the way of clues, But this thing is like, I promise you, like, if you're a medical student listening to this podcast, between now that you're listening to this podcast and the time you graduate from medical school, you will get at least 10 questions on this one concept I'm about to talk about. So essentially, the thing that happens is that you'll have, your next step in management is to give those people a Prostadil, which is a prostaglandin E1 analog, right? It's a prostaglandin E1 analog. The reason you give that is, let me explain the reason why those kids have those symptoms in the first place. The reason those kids have those symptoms in the first place is, what must have likely happened is that those kids, they must have had some kind of really bad cyanotic heart defect that did not get expressed because they may have had like a conduit, a shunt, causing mixing of blood between the right and the left sides of the heart, like a PDA, for example, that's, you know, masking that cyanotic congenital heart defect. But the thing is, once you get born, that PDA begins to close. And if that PDA closes, that will then unmask the cyanotic congenital heart defect those kids have. Okay? So the thing you do under those circumstances is you give out Prostadil, which is a PGE1 analog, and that would essentially keep the doctor's arteriosus open so that you can buy time before you go to cardiac surgery, essentially. Again, I promise you, this thing is ridiculously high yield to know. Like, again, it's tested all the time on step one, on step two CK, and the pediatric shelf in third year. So again, all big high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And remember the egg on a string appearance of the transposition of the great vessels. And obviously, right, you're going to do surgery for that. And then, I mean, the total anomalous pulmonary venous return. I talked about this in the context of the snowman sign on imaging, right? I remember essentially, look at the name. It tells you essentially all you need to know. Total anomalous pulmonary venous return. That means the pulmonary vein is returning blood to the heart in an anomalous fashion. Normally, you're supposed to return blood to the pulmonary vein is supposed to return blood to the left atrium, but if it returns blood to the right atrium instead, that's what happens in TAP-VR. There are like many types of TAP-VR, but that's beyond the scope of our discussion, and you'll very likely not see that tested on your exams. And then remember, right, the tricuspid atresia, right? This can essentially happen where, you know, you essentially have no communication between the right atrium, right ventricle. Again, remember, this is not very compatible with life. So the only way a kid with tricuspid atresia can get born is they need an ASD and they need a VSD. They need both to live. Essentially, the thing that happens is, well, actually, they can probably do fine with just an ASD, because that blood in the right atrium will go to the left atrium, and then from the left atrium, it will go to the left ventricle, and then from the left ventricle, it will go to the aorta, and then maybe it can go through like the pulmonary artery, left ventricle to the aorta, and then maybe through a doctor's arteriosus to a pulmonary artery. But the classic teaching and the thing you will likely see on an MBME exam is that a kid with tricuspid atresia typically needs an ASD and a VSD to be born. That ASD will help you go from the right, will help the blood go from the right atrium to the left ventricle, from the right atrium to the left atrium. And then the VSD will help the blood go from the left ventricle back to the right ventricle, so that that blood can then go from the right ventricle to the pulmonary artery and then get oxygenated. Okay, so those are essentially the big shunts you need in a person that has a tricuspid atresia. And then the last one I'll mention is like truncus arteriosus. This one, the big association we want to remember is, essentially these people again have issues with the aortico pulmonary septum. So essentially, like, the aorta and the pulmonary artery are really not divided. There is like one common vessel that leads out of both sides of the heart, which is obviously not a good thing, right? It's a cyanotic defect because you're essentially having mixing of blood. And remember that truncus arteriosus has a very high yield association with DeGeorge syndrome, right? Remember, DeGeorge syndrome arises where you have problems with the development of the third and the fourth pharyngeal pouches. Again, these are all high yield ways your friends at the MBME love to integrate these concepts on exams. So a mnemonic I maybe can give you is that all these cyanotic heart defects, they all tend to start with the letter T. Okay, they all tend to start with the letter T. So I think I'm going to, you know, go ahead and stop here. One thing I'll say is, if you're a med student, you know, set of going into your third year, it probably makes sense for you to also like watch my PEDS video. My PEDS video, I talk about these congenital heart defects from a PEDS perspective, like a PEDS shelf perspective. because there are some other nuances to this to these congenital heart defects that, again, they don't seem to, for whatever reason, be emphasized in many resources. So I sort of talk about them in terms of like increased pulmonary venous markings and all that. I mean, pulmonary arterial blood markings and all that stuff. But that's more for third. That's more appropriate for like third year. But if you want like a clinical treatment, and let's say you're a second year med student, you can just go and find the part of my PEDS video where I talk about the congenital heart defects, and then maybe take things from there. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams: step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And then if I do this USMLE booster course, right, where it's like 10 hours for step 2 CK and step 3, or 20 hours for step 1, where if you're like at the end of your dedicated period, or you know, you're like, okay, I feel good about my knowledge base, let me have someone put everything together for me in a very short period of time. That's what that course is essentially for. And basically the thing I do in that course is I teach you, it's a Q&A format, it's clinical vignettes for the most part. What I talk about, and it's very rapid fire questioning, but we touch on a lot of like the high yield must know concepts for the USMLE exams when we do those things. So if you're interested, again, reach out to me either through the website or you send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And then I also do this thing that I call longitudinal tutoring, where if you're like a first, second, or third year med student, I can teach you for your, like, essentially tutor you for your different exams, like the exams you take in med school. But as I'm tutoring you for those exams, like your block exams, your shelf exams, I also tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exam, right? And again, the vast majority of people have done this with you, been like very successful. And then if you're like a med student applying to like residency, so like an ERAS application, an ERASAP or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCASAP, and I do offer like one-on-one like advising, coaching, like mock interviews, personal statement writing, editing your application, rec letters and things like that. Those are all things I can kind of help out with. So if that's something you're interested in, especially if you're an international medical graduate, feel free to reach out to me. And then if you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for like the medicine in training exam or the ABIM board exam, I do also offer a one-on-one tutoring for that. I've definitely tutored a medicine resident. So yeah, if that's anything you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me for that. And then if you have like a college body that needs tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, again, I offer tutoring for all those things. So I'll continue this cardiology business. Again, I feel like cardiology will probably end up being my most detailed step one podcast because there's just so much in cardio. And the thing is, cardio, unfortunately, is just one of those things that I cannot just breeze through giving you like, oh, this is high yield, this is high yield. I actually need to explain, because the thing is, if you don't have the, like, cardiology is one of those things where if you memorize it, you will not get cardiology questions right on the USMLE exams. It's something you kind of need to understand. So that's why I'm taking like the extra time to, you know, put in that investment of time so that you actually understand what's going on. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I will see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.